Iran's foreign minister says if the U.S. really wants an agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal, it must prove this in practice and take steps in that direction. Ukraine says it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis over reduced gas supplies from Russia. Also ahead, dozens of former U.S. officials are to announce a third national political party in reaction to America's increasingly polarized and gridlocked political system. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's foreign minister has reiterated his country's determination to reach a good and durable agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a phone call with the European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell. Amir Abdullahian said a good agreement would be at hand if the American side took realistic steps in that direction. Iran's top diplomat said if the U.S. is really willing to clinch a deal with Iran, it must prove this in practice. Amir Abdullahian also touched on Borrell's proposed text for an agreement to revive the JCPOA, saying that Iran welcomes the continuation of talks and diplomacy. Borrell, for his part, said the Iranian side has so far proven its serious resolve during the JCPOA revival talks, and it is time for those talks to bear fruit. This came a day after Borrell wrote in a Financial Times article that he has put on the table a draft agreement to revive the JCPOA that addresses the removal of anti-Iran sanctions and some other remaining differences. Masoud Shajarab, head of London-based Islamic Human Rights Commission, says the West should not expect Iran to fulfill its JCPOA commitments if it cannot reap the economic benefits of the deal.
The reality is that I think it is only right to say that if Iran is not going to benefit from economically and from removal of the sanction, then the West should not be in a position to actually expect the part of Iran to be fulfilled by the Iranian. And I just hope that we will see the end of this tit-for-tat, and the United States and the West will decide to uphold its commitment, so Iran could go back to its commitment also. But I think what is very obvious is that commitment cannot be one-sided.
Turning elsewhere, Ukraine says it will increase electricity exports to the European Union as the bloc faces an energy crisis triggered by reduced gas supplies from Russia.
We are preparing to increase our electricity exports to consumers in the European Union. Despite the war, we secured the connection of the Ukrainian power grid to the entire European energy system in a record time. Our exports allow us not only to generate foreign currency revenues, but also help our partners withstand Russian energy pressure.
Zelensky added that his country will become one of the guarantors of the European energy security. The Ukrainian power grid was connected to the European network in mid-March. The connection enabled Ukraine to receive electricity from Europe if military attacks caused outages. In early July, Ukraine started exporting electricity to the EU via Romania. On Wednesday, Germany said Russia has cut gas deliveries to Europe via the Nord Stream pipeline to about 20% of capacity, down from 40%. EU countries accuse Russia of reducing gas supplies in response to Western sanctions imposed on Moscow over the Ukraine war. Moscow, however, blames technical issues with the pipeline for gas supply cuts.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to, and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying. But the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Staying in Europe and the UK, some of discontent continues with yet another major rail strike over paid jobs and working conditions, bringing widespread delays and cancellations. It comes a month after London's subway workers staged a 24-hour walkout, prompting transport chaos in the capital. Said Pereza has the report from the British capital.
Another day, another railway strike, bringing half of Britain's rail network to a grinding halt. Organized by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, the 24-hour industrial action has seen more than 40,000 railway workers walk out in a row over job security and pay at a time of soaring inflation. Any hope of an 11th-hour settlement has now been all but dashed.
We're just outside one of the busiest train stations in London, where members of the RMT union have formed a picket line demanding a fair deal. And they're saying if there isn't a negotiated settlement soon, there will be more walkouts in the weeks ahead.
Those words echoed by the head of the RMT union, that industrial action is the way forward.
I can't think of a way at the moment because we've been negotiating for 2 years. But it would be interesting if me and Grant Shapps went head to head. We could see how we got on with that, if that's not too flippant.
Grant Shapps is the transport secretary. Under him, the rail network and the subway have seen billions of dollars in cuts and offered below-inflation pay rises, described by the strikers as paltry. As widespread as the disruption is support for the railway workers. Today, the strikers found Britain's shadow transport secretary joining the picket line in central London.
When Grant Shapps and Liz Truss come on the telly and say to you that it's someone else's fault, it's the striking rail workers' fault that this dispute is happening, what a load of nonsense. The Trade Union Congress had a legal opinion just a few weeks ago that showed definitively that it is the government who are agitating for this dispute. And it needs to be resolved. It needs to be resolved fairly and justly and quickly for the sake of the travelling public.
The travellers, too, want the dispute resolved quickly.
I love the railway, I love to travel by train, I want to keep doing it, and I don't want to keep thinking, oh God, is it going to be, you know, unreliable?
I totally get why they're striking. Obviously it's an inconvenience for me, but I'm willing to make an exception.
There are more railway walkouts planned for the coming weeks. There are also reports of unrest among teaching staff and National Health Service employees. More disquiet is on the horizon as Britain awaits a new Prime Minister. Saeed Pereza, London.
Elsewhere, dozens of former U.S. officials, both Republican and Democratic, are going to announce a third national political party. They say the new party will appeal to millions of voters, dismayed with the country's, quote, dysfunctional two-party system. The new party, called Forward, will initially be co-chaired by a former Democratic presidential candidate and a former Republican governor of New Jersey. The founding members hope the party would become a viable alternative to the Republican and Democratic parties. The new party is being formed by a merger of three political groups that have emerged in recent years as a reaction to America's increasingly polarized and gridlocked political system. This came after a Gallup poll last year showed a record 2/3 of Americans believed a third party was needed. No information has been released on the party's policy, but it will be centrist. Staying in the U.S., where two former police officers have been sentenced to prison terms for their roles in the May 2020 killing of an unarmed African American. A U.S. district judge sentenced J. Alexander Kuyang to 3 years in prison and Cho Thao to 3.5 years. The two officers were convicted of violating George Floyd's civil rights by failing to stop the use of, quote, unreasonable force by another officer. Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck for nearly 10 minutes until he passed out and died. He was found guilty of murder and is serving more than 20 years in prison. The fourth officer was also convicted of violating Floyd's civil rights and was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison. A video of Floyd handcuffed and pleading with Chauvin for his life prompted outrage in the days after the incident. Floyd's death led to huge daily protests against racism and police brutality in cities around the world. When it comes to U.S. weapons sales, it's not just about profits. Washington's foreign policy initiatives should also be counted, as can be seen in its deals with countries in West Asia. But the U.S. aggression against China is another reason which may explain why it's planning to sell almost $1 billion worth of arms to Japan and Singapore.
The United States has given the green light to more arms sales to East Asian nations in a bid to counter China. The package of arms and munitions, which is worth $900 million, has been approved by the State Department and is set to be sold to Australia, Japan, and Singapore. A potential deal with Australia includes 80 Lockheed Martin precision-guided air-to-surface missiles and associated equipment. The deal, which is said to be worth $235 million, will allow Australian jets to stay outside the range of the opponent's air defense units while launching attacks. Back in April, Canberra approved that $2.44 billion US dollars worth of, quote, improved weapon capabilities be quickly delivered to the country from the US. Australian officials claim they need the equipment to meet the country's increasingly complex and challenging strategic environment. The package for Japan would include 150 advanced medium-range air-to-air missiles. The missiles, which are to be installed on the country's F-35 fighter jets, are worth more than $290 million. Singapore will receive $630 million to supply its fighter jets with air-to-air missiles. Australia, Japan, and Singapore are considered U.S. allies in the Indo-Pacific region against what Washington describes as the rising threat from China.
Yeah, this one, these sales of weapon to Japan and Singapore basically came after a speech of General Milley, where he complained about the aggression, the posture of the Chinese military, especially the pilot, when they intercept any aircraft from the United States or from their ally. So they said that they wanted to give a weapon to be effective against possible interception of aircraft.
Washington's policy towards Beijing has taken a military turn. Hot button issues like Taiwan, trade war, and the disputed islands in the South China Sea are examples of such tensions. And it's widely believed that the latest U.S. arms sales to countries in the East Asia region are to counter the influence of China. But the real question is whether these countries are on board the U.S. aggressive push against China.
The sales of advanced weapons to U.S. allies in the region come amid rising rivalries between the United States and China. Washington is pursuing a policy of cooperation and coordination with regional countries against China. It aims to push these countries to contribute more to joint regional military programs. It's now believed that the United States, which has been the preeminent military power in that region for decades, can no longer guarantee by itself a regional balance of power. Global geopolitics is changing, contrary to the expectations and demands of politicians in Washington. It's now an open secret that China is a rising military and economic powerhouse in the East Asia region. With major advances in missile technology, naval forces and intelligence, China is well on its way to becoming world-class military power. It has already surpassed Washington in several areas. And apart from that, China has massive economic ties with the regional countries. China is concerned about the belligerent rhetoric coming from the US. Beijing and Washington have been at odds over several issues in recent years, including trade and the South China Sea. But Beijing's ultimate concern is Washington's meddling in Chinese Taipei. China has made it clear that it will not allow the self-ruled island to secede. It has already strongly warned against a potential visit by the U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the dispute over the strategic island may prove to be a real challenge between the two superpowers in the coming years.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The EU, NATO, and the West are not only losing the global battle of narratives, they have never won it in the first place, says Ramzi Baru, journalist, in an article published under the heading The War Diplomat: How Borrell and the West Lost the Global Battle of Narratives. Stay tuned for the details of this article. In a blog entry reflecting on the G20 foreign ministers' meeting in Bali, Indonesia, on July 7th to 8th, the High Representative of the European Union, Joseph Borrell, seems to have accepted the painful truth that the West is losing what he termed the global battle of narratives. Borrell admitted, "The global battle of narratives is in full swing, and for now, we are not winning." Borrell's piece is a testimony to the very erroneous logic that led to the so-called Battle of Narratives being lost in the first place. Borrell starts by reassuring his readers that despite the fact that many countries in the global south refuse to join the West sanctions on Russia, everybody agrees, though, in abstract terms, on the need for multilateralism and defending principles such as territorial sovereignty. The immediate impression that such a statement gives is the West is the global vanguard of multilateralism and territorial sovereignty. The opposite is true. The U.S. Western military interventions in Iraq, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, and many other regions around the world have largely taken place without international consent and without any regard for the sovereignty of nations. In the case of the NATO war on Libya, a massively destructive military campaign was initiated based on the intentional misinterpretation of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973, which called for the use of all means necessary to protect civilians. Borrell, like other Western diplomats, conveniently omits the West's repeated and ongoing interventions in the affairs of other nations, while painting the Russian-Ukraine crisis as the starkest example of blatant violations of international law. Would Borrell employ such a strong language to depict the numerous ongoing war crimes in parts of the world involving European countries or their allies? For example, France's despicable war record in Mali, or even more obvious, the 75-year-old Israeli regime occupation of Palestine? When addressing food and energy security, Borrell lamented that many in the G20 have bought into the propaganda and lies regarding the actual cause of the food crisis. Again, Borrell was selective with his logic. While naturally, a war between the two countries that contribute a large share of the world's basic food supplies will detrimentally impact food security, Borrell made no mention that the thousands of sanctions imposed by the West on Moscow have disrupted the supply chain of many critical products, raw material, and basic food items. When the West imposed those sanctions, it only thought of its national interest, erroneously centered around defeating Russia. Neither the people of Sri Lanka, Somalia, Lebanon, nor frankly Ukraine were relevant factors in the West's decision. Borrell, whose job as a diplomat suggests that he should be investing in diplomacy to resolve conflicts, has repeatedly called for widening the scope of war on Russia, insisting that the war can only be won on the battlefield. Such statements were made with Western interest in mind, despite the obvious devastating consequences that Borrell's battlefield would have on the rest of the world. Still, Borrell had the audacity to chastise G20 members for behaving in ways that seemed, to him, focused solely on their national interest. The hard truth is that national interests often outweigh general commitments to bigger ideals, he wrote. If defeating Russia is central to Borrell's and the EU's bigger ideals, why should the rest of the world, especially in the global south, embrace the West's self-serving priorities? Borrell also needs to be reminded that the West's global battle of narratives has been lost well before February 24th. Much of the global South rightly sees the West's interests at odds with its own. This seemingly cynical view is an outcome of decades. In fact, hundreds of years of real experiences, starting with colonialism and ending presently with the routine military and political interventions. Borrell speaks of bigger ideals as if the West is the only morally mature entity that is capable of thinking about rights and wrongs in a selfless, detached manner. In addition to there being no evidence to support Borrell's claim, such condensing language, itself an expression of cultural arrogance, makes it impossible for non-Western countries to accept or even engage with the West regarding the morality of its politics. Borrell, for example, accuses Russia of a deliberate attempt to use food as a weapon against the most vulnerable countries in the world, especially in Africa. Even if we accept this problematic premise as a morally driven position, how can Borrell justify the West sanctions that have effectively starved many people in vulnerable countries around the world? Perhaps Afghans are the most vulnerable people in the world today, thanks to the 20 years of a devastating US-NATO war, which has killed and maimed tens of thousands. Though the US and its Western allies were forced out of Afghanistan last August, billions of dollars of Afghan money are illegally frozen in Western bank accounts, pushing the whole country to the brink of starvation. Why can Borrell not apply his bigger ideals in this particular scenario, demanding immediate unfreezing of Afghan money? In truth, Borrell, the EU, NATO, and the West are not only losing the global battle of narratives, they have never won it in the first place. Winning or losing that battle never mattered to Western leaders in the past, because the Global South was hardly considered when the West made its unilateral decisions regarding war, military interventions, or economic sanctions. The Global South matters now, simply because the West is no longer determining all political outcomes, as was often the case. Russia, China, India, and others are now relevant because they can collectively balance out the skewed global order that has been dominated by Borrell and his likes for far too long.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear listeners, my very dear sisters, welcome to the realm of ladies. You are listening to IRB English Radio and this is Muslim Lady, in which we're going to discuss all the matters of women. So I am Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and here with me I have my very dear friend, Sister Sadiqa, who is going to help us with the questions. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back here again.
Well, the pleasure is all ours. Thank you for being here. Being a girl is very difficult, isn't it?
A lot of pressures, a lot of expectations.
Yes, exactly.
And a lot of responsibilities.
So much of responsibilities that are put to your shoulder from the time that you're just a kiddo, and then it's been imposed to you by nature.
Not only niche, I think a lot of responsibilities as well keep on with, as society changes, women are now taking on more roles than
exactly,
they did before.
Yeah.
So now women are the breadwinners, they're family owners, they can be single moms,
yeah.
They can be the main household nurturer.
Mm-hmm.
And As everything. We continue,
everything,
yes,
great in this world. A woman can do it all.
Now she's had to take on many roles than she did before.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so all her responsibilities are growing as time goes by.
Definitely.
So ever since she's a little kid, she starts to understand the concept of motherhood.
Yes.
Which is very, very sweet. And at the very same time, as you grow older, that feeling inside you is going to grow as well. And then when you come to a specific age, which you have to be a mother, sometimes it gets problematic.
Yes, it does. I guess it comes down to motherhood is taught to children from a very young age, especially girls, like you mentioned. They're mm-hmm. often given dolls to take care of.
Yeah.
If they have younger siblings, they are tasked with childcare from a very
exactly.
young age. And they're taught that they have to be the sole parent as they grow up. Oh, they have to be, not the sole parent, I'll rephrase that. They have to be the sole caregiver of the child.
Yeah.
While it is a shared responsibility.
And by the way, no one teaches them to be a mother. But when they are 3 or 4, they start to be the mother of their dolls.
Yes, that is partly instinctive in them.
Yeah.
And partly as well as they
something
grow up.
Something intuitive.
Yes, and as they grow up, because they are tasked with taking care of their siblings, I mm-hmm. guess that instinct becomes stronger.
Exactly, yeah,
and
stronger.
The practice is there as well for them. I guess it is society's yeah. way, or rather sometimes nature's way of preparing them for what's to come. Mm-hmm.
So it's a wish for all the girls to be mothers. No matter how accomplished they are, no matter how busy they are, but they have this wish inside them that one day they're going to be a mother of a child.
I wouldn't say all women want to be there, but yes, there's a good proportion of women.
Is there anyone who would claim yes. that I don't like to be a mother?
Yes, there are many women who choose to get into marriages with the condition, with the precondition that they will not have children.
Oh my God, that's so brutal. I don't believe it suits a woman's nature. So this is against Islamic belief.
Islam's position on marriage is to procreate, yes. Is it completely against Islamic beliefs is something that people would see problematic, mainly because we do have issues such as infertility. So if a woman can't conceive, then she cannot be blamed for being un-Islamic or not being a Muslim woman or not having an Islamic worldview.
So exactly right in here, you opened up that Pandora's box.
Yes.
When you started talking about infertility. So yes. Dear listeners, in today's episode, we're going to discuss infertility, and I guess we're going to have two segments. In the first segment, we're going to discuss infertility and the mental issues that would bring with itself. And then in the second one, we're going to talk on infertility based on Islamic beliefs and how is the perspective of Islamic narrations towards infertility. But before we get to the main ideas of the first segment, let's go for a little break and we'll be back in no time. Thank you for listening.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Well, sister, is the woman to be blamed for not being capable of conceiving a child?
So infertility is a couple's issue. It's yes. not a woman's issue. It's not a man's issue. Mm-hmm. Because it takes two people to conceive a child.
Exactly. So no one is to blame. The it's first no one point is to get blame. It straight.
Exactly. And what many people need to keep in mind is that do not let infertility define you. It is just like every other issue. It comes mm-hmm. on you. It is a test. A person, and in some cases it is a health issue, so they might be suffering from some problems in their reproductive organs that is causing infertility.
And then maybe those problems could be solved.
Yes, they can be solved. So infertility should not define a couple, neither should it define any one of them.
Exactly.
It's just like any other disease if it is a health issue. We do not let a cancer patient be defined by cancer.
Yeah.
Therefore, we should not define a person who's struggling with infertility should not be defined by that mm-hmm. problem. It is just something that has come to them. Something that can be solved by many, especially with the way science has progressed. We've had many successful results now.
Exactly, yeah. Everything has improved.
So it does come as to how they then work together to solve these issues. I think sometimes what happens is that people go for children. In some marriages, when the marriage is struggling from that basics, they try to have children in order to strengthen the marriage.
Yeah.
But then when infertility comes, the marriage breaks down.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's why when it comes to infertility, there is a very, very important need for the couples to work together.
No, and there's a question, sister. Do you think the situation has changed toward these women compared to many years ago? Do you think that people now would look at them as just the way you defined it? It's a kind of disease that has to be solved and it's not going to define you.
Perhaps, yes, there is the change that is coming along. But the problem is that many women, and I particularly mention women because women are made to believe that their prime role is only to conceive.
Yeah.
So when they cannot conceive, that guilt comes along in them.
Exactly.
And that guilt overtakes them to an extent that they themselves might start defining themselves as a barren.
Yeah,
which is a very rude word to
use.
Yeah,
exactly.
But we have to use it because we need to let people know that do not let these things define you. It is just another disease, as we mentioned. This guilt as well overtakes them to such an extent that their mental health is affected greatly.
Yeah.
And in some cases, their relationship with their friends, their family, their own husbands as well
and
gets affected.
And the husband has got a very important role in that point.
Yes, because infertility is not only a women's issue, like I mentioned. Sometimes it can be an issue with the woman's reproductive organs, and sometimes it can be an issue with the male reproductive organs. According to statistics, approximately 30% of infertile cases are because of the male reproductive organs. So there could be an issue with the male from the male side. And yes, there could be an issue with the woman's side as well because she's the one who's going to hold the baby.
Yeah, that's very
true. When it comes to infertility, let's say, for example, it is the woman. Okay, let's say she has a problem in her reproductive organs. It's very imperative for the men to then start to be more compassionate towards
her. And supportive.
And very supportive. And she needs to also learn to practice self-compassion, self-love.
Yeah.
Because and celebrate those small victories in life. Mm-hmm. I guess a lot of people who do go through infertility do go to the doctors. They go through many
cycles. Patients at the same time as the support of the husband would do a great deal of job for them. Maybe
yes.
That would even solve the problem.
It wouldn't solve, but it would help a lot because they would learn to take each step at a time rather than take it all at once because all at once becomes very overwhelming. Especially like we said, women have many roles in society today. Women are also breadwinners. They're also working. They also have responsibilities to their families and household responsibilities as well.
And just imagine the mental issues comes in the way as well.
And then, yes, we add infertility, the guilt, the self-hate.
The burden.
Exactly. It becomes so overwhelming that she's not able to deal with it. And at some point, that pot is going to crack, right? If you fill a water to it, if you fill a pot to its top, it's going to fall. It's going to flow out.
Yeah.
And we don't want that to happen.
Exactly.
Because infertility requires a lot of peace of mind. A woman needs to be sleeping properly, she needs to be eating better in order to help her cycles if she's going through any infertility treatments.
Yeah, because maybe one of the causes of infertility is also stress.
Yes, it does. It does contribute to degrading her health state.
Yeah.
So yes, there
and
is
her reproductive system as well.
Infertility treatments do require a lot of invasive treatment,
yeah,
a lot of blood tests, a lot of injections, hormone injections, going for several rounds of blood testing and everything. So keeping that state of mind is imperative for there to be a success in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And like we say, don't let these things define you. They're just like every other treatment that a person needs to get through.
Exactly.
And then it also comes down to the family, right? A lot of the times, they're well-wishers, right?
Yeah.
But the way they say it is not always nice.
Exactly.
You know, especially when you have grandparents who are so looking forward to a child.
Yeah. And they insist so much on that idea while they shouldn't do so, because the couple already are going through too much of pain.
And sometimes they might not insist, but they do insinuate. Like, every time they meet the couple, I'm
they
praying for you.
They remind you of that point.
Exactly. The couple do know you're praying for them. But take a step back. Not everything has to be about the child if a person's going through it. Exactly. And I think what happens is, as time goes on, when those around the couple keep on talking about children, these couples start to isolate themselves, which brings more problems.
Exactly, yeah.
Therefore,
And depression.
Therefore, it's important for these family to now start to be an emotional support system. Not everything has to be about the child. I don't have to discuss 24/7 about when the child is coming.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah.
So give them space. Let them know you are there for them without constantly barging in on their private life. Right?
That is very important.
There are support groups popping up around the world because this issue of infertility is becoming quite common. And if these couples can find support groups where they can go and express and be with like-minded people,
yeah,
it helps
true.
Them understand that they are not in this alone and they don't have to isolate.
Yeah, that is very
they
true.
They don't have to feel alone. Sometimes those who are going through treatments, they will go through several cycles of treatments. Like let's say they're going through either IUI in the start or IVF. So if they have a small victory in one of their treatments, celebrate it and let's get on to the next step.
Yeah, thank you, sister. I'm sure we're going to have a lot more to say, but we're running out of time and we have to bid the audience farewell. So we were talking about infertility in women. We said that such a passionate creature going through such an important phase of infertility, she needs support and she needs some time and a space and peace of mind. So don't insist on couples too much and let them solve their issues together and let time be the one that is going to help the issue and solve it all. So thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell.
Who is the love one?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammad Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Mark Shorter was chief of staff of Vice President Mike Pence, and Greg Jacob, a lawyer for Mike Pence, have been subpoenaed in the Justice Department's expanding criminal inquiry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Top Pence aides testified to grand jury in January 6 investigation. Two top aides to former Vice President Mike Pence testified last week to a federal grand jury in Washington investigating the events surrounding the January 6 attack on the Capitol, the highest-ranking officials of the Trump administration so far known to have cooperated with the Justice Department's widening inquiry into the events leading up to the assault on the Capitol. The appearances before the grand jury of the men Mark Short, who was Mike Pence's chief of staff, and Greg Jacob, who was his counsel, were the latest indication that the Justice Department's criminal investigation into the events surrounding and preceding the riot is intensifying after weeks of growing questions about the urgency the department has put on examining former President Donald J. Trump's potential criminal liability. The testimony of the two Pence aides marked the first time it has become publicly known that figures with first-hand knowledge of what took place inside the White House in the tumultuous days before the attack have cooperated with federal prosecutors. Both Mark Short and Greg Jacob played important roles in describing to a House Select Committee conducting a parallel investigation of the Capitol attack how Donald Trump, working with allies like the lawyer John Eastman, mounted a campaign to pressure Mike Pence into disrupting the normal counting of Electoral College votes on 6 of January 2021 as part of an effort to keep Donald Trump in office. Mark Short's testimony was confirmed by two people familiar with it, as was Greg Jacobs. The Justice Department has at times appeared to be lagging behind the House Select Committee, which has spoken to more than 1,000 witnesses, including some from inside the Trump White House. Much of the testimony has been highlighted at a series of public hearings over the past 2 months. It remains unclear precisely what Mark Short and Greg Jacob told the grand jury or what questions prosecutors may have asked them. But both previously gave recorded and transcribed interviews to the House Committee, and Mr. Jacob served as a live witness at one of the panel's public hearings that focused on the effort to strong-arm Mike Pence. Mark Short and Greg Jacob were present in the Oval Office for a meeting on 4th of January 2021 at which Donald Trump had John Eastman try to persuade Mike Pence that he could delay or block congressional certification of Mr. Trump's Electoral College defeat. John Eastman's plan relied on Mike Pence being willing to accept, as he presided over a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021, that there were disputes over the validity of electors whose votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. had already been certified by the states, a baseless assertion that had been promoted by a number of Trump allies in the previous weeks as a last-ditch way to help keep Donald Trump in office. Mike Pence ultimately rejected Donald Trump's pressure on him to go along with the plan, but the so-called fake electors proposal has been one of the primary lines of inquiry to have become public in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation. Mark Short also provided the House Committee with testimony that highlighted the sense of threat that built from Donald Trump's efforts to derail the congressional proceedings on 6th of January 2021. He told the House Committee how he had informed Mr. Pence's lead Secret Service agent on 5th of January 2021 that Donald Trump was about to publicly turn on Mike Pence over his refusal to go along with the electors' plan, potentially placing a target on his former boss's back. On 6th of January 2021, some members of the mob of Trump supporters that attacked the Capitol chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." Donald Trump reacted approvingly to the chants, effectively saying that Mike Pence deserved it, according to testimony collected by the House Committee. Mark Short's testimony to the federal grand jury was reported earlier by ABC News. Greg Jacobs' testimony was reported earlier by the Wall Street Journal. Until now, the only other pro-Trump figure, aside from rioters who were at the Capitol, known to have testified in front of a federal grand jury investigating January 6, was the prominent Stop the Steal organizer, Ali Alexander. Mr. Alexander, acting on a subpoena from prosecutors, answered questions in front of the grand jury for about 3 hours in late June. Prosecutors have also issued grand jury subpoenas to several people connected to the scheme to create false slates of electors, saying that Mr. Trump won the 2020 presidential election in swing states that were actually won by Joseph Biden Jr. Those who have received the subpoenas have largely been state lawmakers or Republican officials, many of whom put their names on documents attesting to the fact that they were electors for Donald Trump. The subpoenas, some of which have been obtained by the New York Times, show that prosecutors are interested in collecting information on a group of pro-Trump lawyers who helped to devise and carry out the plan. Among the lawyers named in the subpoenas are Rudolph Giuliani, who helped oversee Donald Trump's challenges to the election, and John Eastman, an outside lawyer who drafted several memos encouraging Donald Trump to use the fake electors as part of the campaign to pressure Mike Pence to throw him the election. Last month, federal agents stopped John Eastman outside a restaurant in New Mexico and seized his cell phone. On that same day, agents also seized electronic devices from another lawyer involved in the fake elector scheme, Jeffrey Clark. Mr. Clark, a former Justice Department official, helped draft a letter to state officials in Georgia falsely stating that the department had evidence of election fraud in the state. If the grand jury testimony of Mark Short and Greg Jacob echoed their interviews with the House Committee, it suggests that prosecutors have likely homed in on how Donald Trump and his allies sought to pressure Mike Pence into ignoring or refusing to accept some states of electors as he oversaw the final certification of the election. The effort to pressure Mike Pence into derailing certification of the Electoral College results was the chief focus of one of the House Committee's hearings in June. The panel provided evidence at the hearing that Donald Trump went along with the scheme despite having been told it was illegal. At the hearing, the House Committee played videotape testimony in which Greg Jacob said that John Eastman had admitted in front of Donald Trump at the January 4th meeting, 2 days before the riot, that his plan to have Mike Pence obstruct the electoral certification violated the Electoral Count Act. Greg Jacob testified to the committee that Mike Pence knew early on that the plan was unlawful. Mr. Pence's first reaction upon hearing of it, Greg Jacob said, was that there was no way this was justifiable. The pressure campaign against Mike Pence by Donald Trump and John Eastman also played a central role in a court decision this spring by a federal judge in California who said that Donald Trump and John Eastman had most likely committed federal crimes, such as obstruction of a congressional proceeding and conspiracy to defraud the United States. In the decision, which emerged from John Eastman's attempts to stop the House panel from gaining access to his emails, the judge, David Carter, noted that Donald Trump had facilitated 2 meetings in the days before the January 6th riot that were explicitly tied to persuading Vice President Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress. At the first meeting on 4th of January, Donald Trump and John Eastman invited Mike Pence, Mark Short and Greg Jacob to the Oval Office. There, Judge Carter wrote, John Eastman presented his plan to Vice President Mike Pence, focusing on either rejecting electors or delaying the count. That meeting was followed by another, Judge Carter wrote, on 5th of January 2021, during which John Eastman sought again to persuade Greg Jacob to go along with the scheme. Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history, Judge David Carter wrote.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.